Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
They keep saying they're about to do it. And then, you know, we see videos like FSD V14 Lite this week running over a log that it didn't see. You know?
That was crazy. Hello and welcome back to the Plugged In Podcast, a weekly news show from Inside EVs all about the future of transportation. I'm Tim Levin.
And I'm Mac Hogan.
On this week's show, we talk e-bikes. Mac and I both were reviewing e-bikes for the last couple months and had a really fun time doing that. So we'll talk about what we thought. We also have an upcoming Tesla Cybercab launch event to talk about and Hyundai's new EREV plans.
Let's get into it.
This episode of the Plugged In Podcast by Inside EVs is presented by Hankook Tire.
Hey everyone, it's me, Olivia, at Demo Days 2026 in Los Angeles, California. In addition to our booth, we've actually got a ride and drive portion where you guys can come and test out our tires for yourselves. Thank you guys for joining us here at the Hankook booth at Demo Days LA. We'll see you next time.
Alrighty. Why don't you start us off with e-bikes? Because it was your idea to kind of talk about our thoughts here.
Yeah, I think this is something we want to talk about because it's something you and I have talked a lot about offline in terms of our experience with these. So we both had e-bikes on test for the last couple of months.
A phenomenon known as slack law.
Slack law, yeah. Once you talk about it too much, you got to bring it into the content mines, you know, go mining for some gold. But yeah, so we have done some blogs on e-bikes. This was honestly, the e-bike fixation was, I feel like, started by our social editor, Maddox K, who loves e-bikes, big fan. But obviously, it's something that is very much within our remit as like they're electric vehicles, they're micro-mobility. They're a key part of certain parts of our transit infrastructure when it comes to like food delivery or urban mobility. So it's something we want to talk about, but it's also kind of the Wild West out there in more ways than one in terms of how to review these well. I mean, who these are for, what the like long-term view of this segment even is. So I wanted to sort of step back and just start off with like what we've experienced so far. Tell me a little bit about the e-bikes that you've experienced both on this review cycle, but also just throughout your life.
I love e-bikes. I'm in the Maddox camp of e-bikes. I used to own a folding e-bike from a brand called Fido when I lived in New York. And it was like the best thing.
Is that a brand that still exists?
Or? Yeah, it does. Okay. They actually just also reached out about us reviewing those. So maybe more Fido content.
A key problem I have is so many e-bike companies will reach out to us and I'll be like, I don't know which of you is real, which of it is just like a random white label thing. There's so many and they all have like kind of the same specs. It's weird. But anyway, you were saying.
Yeah, I owned one for a while in New York. It was folding so that I could like tuck it into the corner of my tiny apartment. And it was the best way to get around the city. Like a combination of that plus the subway or plus a bus or plus a fare. I didn't do a bus very much.
Yeah.
But
plus combination I'm walking here.
Yeah, exactly. Of bike, e-bike and other transit modes is just the best way to get around a city, I think.
Yeah.
And that was nothing compared to the Aventon Level 3, which is the bike that I've had on loan for the last few months. This is much more, I mean, I think the fact that it's just not a folding bike helps. It just feels like sturdier and better put together. But this is a very popular commuter e-bike and I had a really great time with it. I think Oakland is maybe even a better place for e-bikes than New York, just because New York is like, very hectic for bikes. Mm-hmm. And there's really, really great public transit. So you don't really need an e-bike.
Right.
Here there is not good public transit and there's virtually no traffic compared to a place like New York. And so I've had a great time just going the couple of miles from my apartment to the gym, gym to work, work to the gym, all of that, like
it's
2, 3,
really
4 miles.
Really piss off Californians that you just said Oakland has no traffic.
Well, in the city itself, it's like I mean, yeah, it is. I will stand by that. You know, the city of Oakland itself is like a small New York neighborhood in terms of density. On the highway, yeah, of course, there's tons of traffic. But like in the city, getting around, e-bike has been great. What's been your experience?
Yeah, so I've had random experiences on vacations usually where like anytime I'm in a place that has cool outdoor scenery, like we were in Olympic National Park not that long ago, me and one of my best friends, and we were like, oh, we were going to rent e-bikes and drive 15 miles up this steep mountain grade to a trail that then leads to hot springs and then come back down, and you couldn't get a car up of it because the bridge had washed out, so you had to like hike the bike for like 1 mile. But just that kind of thing of like getting to go really fast in an environment with no cars, I was like, that was really fun. Same thing, we went out to like a ranch out in Arizona and ripped them around on like mountain biking trails, like electric mountain bikes, and that was unbelievably fun. I've done it through another national park. So that was always my experience with e-bikes, is just, wow, a really serene and beautiful, pretty easy way to see whatever you want to see. Just, I always recommend that to people when they go to national parks. Like, there's too much to see that you can see on foot, but also just like seeing it all from a car, you don't get to smell it, you don't get to feel it the same way. So I've loved e-bikes through that context. I've rented them around San Diego. And then earlier this year, I want to say maybe April or so, Tenways, a company, it's a Chinese e-bike company that's big in Europe that's like trying to get more started here, reached out and offered to let me test a Wayfarer, which is kind of their equivalent of an Aventon Level 3. So it's like a traditional bike shape, cargo rack, built-in light, built-in screen, all that. Class 2 default, so 20 mile per hour with a throttle or pedal assist, or Class 3 mode, which then gives you 28 miles per hour, but only on pedal assist, no throttle available. Or technically, you're not supposed to use it on the road, but there is, of course, an unlimited mode that has the 28 mile per hour cap, but still gives you the throttle. Obviously, I've never, ever ridden that on a public road, ever, and I never, ever would ever. But if I did, it would have been pretty nice, because it's cool that you can even... There's a certain road that I have to go on to bike to a lot of places that you really are just in traffic, like you're in a regular lane of traffic that is an important connector road. And so people want to be going the speed limit, which is 25 or 30. And just being able to keep up with them and not have people zooming by me could be really helpful if I ever tried it, but I never would, because that would not comply with California regulations. So anyways,
you're literally about to get swatted.
Yes.
By the bike police.
For sure. So that has been a ton of fun. I have started doing so many of my errands on it. I live in a neighborhood, it's kind of same thing like you're talking about, my part of San Diego. Most things I go to are within 2 or 3 miles. I used to walk to a gym. Now I go to a gym that's a little further away because I can bike to it on the e-bike super easily. My fiance uses it all the time. She's in love with it. And then on top of that, recently I got sent Atos, A-O-T-O-S, Flux X26 Pro, which was like a Kickstarter-funded bike that is supposed to be able to do really good wheelies. You can bump the power up from 500 watts nominal to like 2,000 watts peak. It's a lot faster. It's a lot quicker, but technically it's still a Class 2 when you get it out of the box. And if you want to unlimit it, it's for off-road only. So yeah, I've really enjoyed having the traditional e-bike. This kind of makes me feel a little more like an e-moto. It's only got like one gear on it, and it doesn't really feel like it's built for pedaling. It feels like the pedals exist so that they can classify it as a bike, not a motorcycle. Yeah. And I would say that's maybe my least favorite part of the e-bike experience, which I wanted to make another main part of this conversation, which is this weird gray area of what is an e-bike? What are the legalities around it? You know, if I ride my 10 ways in an, 28 mile per hour mode, am I going to get stopped by a cop who recognizes that I'm using the throttle? If I'm on the e-moto, because it looks so insane, even in Class 2 mode, am I going to have to worry about it? California has pretty strict rules about this now, so do states like New Jersey. So it's kind of weird to be in this gray area where your product could be legal in your state today and illegal in it tomorrow. And I don't think any of the marketing around e-bikes has done a great job of dispelling this, because I mean, like the wheelie capable bike. They want to sell it to 12-year-olds and 16-year-olds that want to absolutely rip on these things. And I get that, but I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's been a problem for a long time, and you're starting to see the regulations sort of catch up and maybe even overreach, I think, in some ways, like in New Jersey, where, you know, a lot of this stuff has been in response to the teens, the kids, like the tweens on super high powered bikes getting hurt or getting killed. Like it's been a problem. But I think that's a very different problem than like me or you riding a class one or class two e-bike that goes 15 or 18 or 20 miles an hour on pedal assist. Like that to me is not substantially more dangerous than a regular bike, which you could totally get up to that speed if you tried, you know, or you're going downhill or something.
I did 35 on my road bike yesterday.
There you go. Yeah. New Jersey passed these rules that are, you know, now e-bikes need to get insured. You know, you need to have a special license. You can only ride them if you're over 15 years old, that kind of thing. So, or I guess you need to have a driver's license, or if you don't have a driver's license, you need to have an e-bike special license.
Okay.
So yeah, it's really interesting, and there's a lot of different approaches to it. And it's going to be interesting to see how these regulations sort of change over time around the country.
Yeah, and honestly, it's not just the regulation thing. It's also part of deprogramming the car-based thinking that I have, which you might have a different perspective as someone who's always lived in a much more walkable place. But like, I grew up in suburban Cleveland. Like, I couldn't walk to that many places. I could bike to these places. And, you know, you lock up your bike or whatever. But e-bikes, where they're most useful, is obviously like dense urban environments, where you kind of got to worry about theft. You got to worry about where it's like cool to park these things, because I feel a little weird. Like my bike is a little weird to try to put into a traditional bike rack because it's a little bit bigger. It's a little bit, you need a heavier duty lock cable because it's more valuable. So I found like adjusting to a lot of those just practicalities of dealing with it as something that you're using for errands and tools, not just is what I've normally done as an adult, use my bike primarily just for fun. I found, you know, there's a couple pain points around that. I still worry a little bit about just the fact that security is kind of left to a lock that I know pretty much anyone motivated could get through pretty easily. And if I don't have a lot of confidence that San Diego PD are going to spend, you know, a lot of resources trying to track down my bike if it were to get stolen. I know you're in Oakland too, which there's, you have concerns around that. So you got to lug your bike into your house, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you'd be crazy, I think, to lock it up in basically any city. You'd be crazy to lock up an expensive e-bike like outside your apartment all the time. So I take it up into my building. All the places that I go, like my office, my gym, they have indoor bike parking, which is great, I did and do with my regular bike. Like I went basically from doing all these errands on a regular, like a vintage mountain bike to doing pretty much everything on the e-bike just because it's so much easier and it gets me. Like, I get there not sweaty, I get there faster, I can go farther, I can go, like, all of Oakland is on sort of a gentle grade that doesn't seem like a lot, but going like 2-3 miles and having to do that both ways, it's kind of a pain in the ass. And the e-bike has made that just so much more enjoyable, to the point where, like, I do stuff like that more. I don't use my car. Like, some of the times when I would use my car to drive to a farther away gym or whatever, or the office, like, I don't because I have the e-bike. I think the one pain point with the level three is something that's, I learned just by living with it for a while, is that it's probably like too much bike for me for that exact reason, in that it weighs like 70 pounds. When I've been shopping for e-bikes, I've been like gravitated toward these sort of chunky commuter bikes or utility bikes just because they seem they look sick and they seem more capable and like you can carry some stuff on the back or whatever. And then I realized that carrying 70 pounds of bike up and down a flight of stairs all the time
is
a lot. Like it's too much.
And so especially 70 pounds in that form factor, right?
Like it's cumbersome. Like there have been multiple times where it's almost like dragged me down, you know, the stairs or whatever. So I have realized that if I was going to buy one, it would probably be one of the more bike shaped, you know, one of the
simple ones,
one of the simpler, like smaller battery, all that.
Yeah.
Because I have really not had an issue with range. Like I've charged this thing. I charge it every once in a while when I see it going down. Like I don't even think about it. So having half the range, I don't think would be a big deal.
No, the Tenways has ostensibly like a 75 or 85 mile, you know, e-bike range, which means they picked a number out of a hat and threw it on the box. So again, Wild West comes to, there's no EPA cycle for any of this crap, but I found I could very realistically in the real world get 50 plus miles without working too hard on it. The furthest I ever really go is to La Jolla and back, which is around 25 miles round trip, 30 miles round trip. And it doesn't ever use more than, I think it used 60% last time. And I was on the throttle pretty hard and moving fast and had snorkeling gear and stuff with me. And, you know, just being able to do that, being able to go up to La Jolla on a crowded Saturday and there's no parking anywhere and just ride right up to the beach with my fins and my mask clipped on the back and then come home, dry off on the bike ride back and feel totally fine on the way back. Like I'm not, you know, overexerting myself or anything like that is really great. And I know you mentioned there's inclines in your neighborhood. That's part of why I do a lot of walking for errands, but I wasn't doing really any errands on my bike because pretty much no matter what you're doing near me, you're going up a pretty significant hill. And so, you know, there's a grocery store that I love that's only a couple miles from my house. I think it's like 1.5 or something, but it's up a giant hill. And so you just, if you're trying to go there on a bike, like you need to like fully commit to the sweaty, you know, whole game. And like I said yesterday, just riding around my neighborhood, I got up to 35 miles per hour because we have really steep hills in the neighborhood. So just being able to not worry about that, like I would not downgrade the motor type because mine's a 500, or the one I'm testing is a 500 watt motor nominal with 750 peak. And when you're going straight up some of the hills in some of my neighborhood, like even with me pedaling, the bike is struggling to keep moving at a consistent rate. So I still feel like for a lot of people, you're going to notice the effort whenever there's any hills, but it's still, it's so easy. And I just wear it in my normal clothes, throw a helmet on. It's just not a big deal at all. I do think though, the one thing we haven't talked about, and maybe you can shed some light on your New York experience, because we are lucky enough to live in two parts of California that basically do not get inclement weather. I mean, more or less, we live in some of the nice weather. How was it owning an e-bike in a city that gets a real winter? Like, did you ever really use it on like snowy times or?
A lot. It definitely cuts the year short. Like it means you're mostly using it half the year. There are hardos in New York who will bike in no matter in every, you know, every day, no matter what. I was not one of those people. But we definitely do have an advantage as like, and it's easy for me to say that e-biking is so much better than driving when I live in a place that's 70 degrees and sunny practically every day.
You think traveling with yourself, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm always by myself. Well, not always by myself, but I'm often by myself.
You're always by, you're a loser.
as somebody who's been into e-bikes for a while, and I wrote a story a few years ago that was all about how they've kind of fit into the EV world, which to me is that, you know, EVs are great. If you're going to have a car, you might as well have a car that emits the least possible.
Yeah.
On top of all the other advantages of EVs, but what's even better and what's really necessary for hitting climate goals is getting people out of cars completely. Like the more trips that you can do, if you can have even a gas car and you can do a lot of your trips on an e-bike, that's also a really big deal for just emissions. So what are you thinking about, you know, how e-bikes, how micromobility fits into the bigger sort of EV world now that you've had experience with it?
Yeah, I think it's always been something I struggle with. Part of it is I want to hear some comments on this one about how much you want us to write about this and talk about it on the pod and things. Like, how much to the audience are you guys plugged into this?
Be careful. Everybody's going to be like, dude, why are you guys talking about it?
I know, but I want to hear that because part of it is, I think it is important, but I think there's a lot of growth yet to come in the micromobility space. I think it is pretty hard ceilinged in a certain way of, like, you grew up in New York, you've lived a car-free life for a lot of your life, but you still have a car because you want to do things outside the city, right? I still have a car for the same reasons. I could technically accomplish all my errands doing everything on the e-bike or whatever, but I want to go further away. I want to go visit friends in, you know, cities that are 45 minutes away, all of that. And I think that is going to be, unless you drastically increase the barriers to driving, be it cost of parking, cost of fuel, cost of the vehicle, I don't think you're going to get Americans out of something car adjacent. I do think there is a world in which cars get smaller and closer to these e-mobility devices, especially as autonomy comes on and you get smaller packages that are, you know, just for one or two people, which we're going to get to when we talk about the cyber cab. But I don't think most trips in America are going to be in something without doors and a pod and climate control for a long time, because a lot of this country is really, like, it's not just winter, it's in Alabama in the height of summer. Do you want to be riding an e-bike? Still no, right? And so I don't think America is going to give up its obsession with personal comfort and climate control. I don't think that's happening. But I do think in urban cores, during the times and places where it makes sense, you're going to see a lot more of these, you know, e-bikes, e-scooters, a lot of innovation in that space, a lot of automation in that space, things that look like e-bikes doing most of the delivery robot work that then, you know, when it gets closer, something else comes out. I think there's a lot of room for micromobility coverage. I just don't think that e-bikes are going to be the backbone of urban transportation in the next 10, 20 years. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. Majority, whatever. I can't really forecast it, but I will say we've already seen a ton of progress. Like, I find it very heartening to see, it was in New York too, but out here every day I see a family, you know, I see a parent dropping kids off at school on like an e-cargo bike.
That's sick.
And that's a thing that didn't really exist, you know, 10 years ago or something.
Yep.
This is kind of a new, you're getting all these new form factors, new types of people realizing that, oh yeah, like, why would I get in my car and drive there and try to find parking or all of that when I can just hop on my bike? These things are expensive, et cetera. But it's really cool to see. And I think it's a good trend overall.
Maybe I'm too much of an American, though. I'm trying to think, would I want to ride to take my kid to school in a cargo e-bike? Because the one thing that being a cyclist and being an e-bike person now, like, really has taught me is just, God, modern drivers are terrifying. And unless we separate out that infrastructure a lot more, there's a whole other safety conversation to be had. I think there's a way to be very safe in it, but trusting the drivers I see around here, around my kids in the back of my e-bike, weird scene.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
But let's talk about something else where we got to see if people are going to trust their families in these. We're going to talk about another autonomy story. I feel like we've been autonomy heavy on this podcast recently, but there's a lot of news coming out, starting with this cybercab, you know, event. So, Tim, why don't you tell us what's going on there?
Yeah, so Tesla has sent out invites for a cybercab launch event. It is happening on September 3rd, next Thursday. Tesla's always very coy about these events. First of all, we did not get an invite, so we don't know exactly what's happening, but there is some kind of event happening. What we're going to get out of it is not super clear, especially since Tesla already, like, had a CyberCab reveal right. a couple of years ago where they revealed the CyberCab, they revealed the RoboVan, and they demonstrated the CyberCab, you know, in this sort of controlled environment. What we're going to get out of this, we don't know. It seems like, based on also reporting from The Information, which says that Tesla's getting ready to launch the CyberCab in Austin, like launch it to streets, seems like this is going to mark that, like them actually putting the CyberCab on the road for people to maybe hail. But we're gonna have to wait and see. What do you want to learn from a CyberCab event?
I mean it's hard with a Tesla event, because what I want to learn
is not what they're gonna tell you.
what they tell me and what I learn are usually different things. It's what I mean, like, you have to spend a lot of time sorting through, which I'm sure we will next week or after this event. But I think it's really frustrating trying to figure out, you know, what's real about this, what's fake. I saw a CyberCab in San Diego yesterday, but like most of them, there was a person in it. They've been parading them all around the country, kind of drumming up hype from this or doing testing, but they're still not doing anything with them right now. So yeah, my assumption will be they're going to roll this out to, you know, some of the beta testers in Austin, cities like that, which I think will be really interesting. You know, one thing I've come to realize is when I was in a Waymo recently, I was in the back seat of it and I was like, dang, I do wish I could sit in the driver's seat. And I know you can sit up front, but I do think having no steering wheel, no pedals and seats up front that you just like get in and you get in where you would be driving and you have the same view where you would be driving, but there's no steering wheel. I think that has a potential to be like a real wow factor in the way that sitting in the back of an I-Pace or a Model Y kind of isn't. It just feels like an Uber with a missing part. But I want to learn a lot more about how all of this is supposed to work. Like, will I really be able to buy one without a steering wheel and pedals? Are they coming without steering wheel and pedals? Are we just going to do, you know, supervised rides for a while where it's only one person? There's a lot of stuff that hasn't been figured out too, including things like the wireless charging. We haven't really seen much movement there on Tesla installing capacity to do that. So yeah, I mean, that's the big question. And will you be able to own it? And when does Tesla say, okay, when it's out being a robo-taxi for you, we are responsible for it and it's level four and you don't have to worry about it? Because you can't, the product does not work unless you have full level four autonomy. And I'm not convinced we're there yet. What do you think about that? I mean, do you think they're close?
I think that's sort of the tension here. It's like, I think the big question around Tesla and the robotaxi is less about what exact form factor it takes. Like, it's more about, can the cars actually successfully drive themselves at scale? Right. And that's something that, to Tesla's credit, they have been like slowly proving that, right? After so many years of self-driving this year, self-driving next year, self-driving this year, they have cars out on the road without a person in the driver's seat, and you can hail it just like a Waymo. The problem is they're at a much smaller scale than Waymo, right? They have about 100 vehicles in Austin, which is their biggest market. They're technically in the Bay Area, but all of those are not actually classified as like robo-taxis.
Yeah.
They have a person in them. They're not like sanctioned by California to be doing autonomous rides. So yeah, it'll be cool. Obviously, it'll be a milestone for them if they can get the CyberCab out, you know, this thing without a steering wheel, without the fail-safe, if they can get it out and do it safely. The kind of strange thing is that they've invested all this money. We know how much it costs to build new vehicle platforms. They've built up a production line. They've been cranking out CyberCabs. I don't know if the software is going to allow them to scale that quickly. Like, at what point, how many CyberCabs you need to have on the road for that whole gigantic investment to make sense versus just you already make Model Ys and Model 3s, like using those. It's ostensibly supposed to be the same hardware and software that you're working on. So there's a lot of questions around it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think to me, in San Diego, only recently started getting fully driverless Waymo testing. It's not open yet. You can't hail them, or at least the public can't hail them. I'm sure they're letting some people do it. But so you start to see these robo-taxis driving around with no one in them. And so people around me are talking to me like, oh, I keep seeing Waymos. They're all over my neighborhood. And then yesterday I see the Cybercab and it's gold and it doesn't look like a Model Y. And I think that's part of why it exists the way it does, that I realize that having a Model Y drive past you is so normal, you're not even going to look at it to notice that there's no one in the driver's seat. And that's why they put the robo-taxi stencil on the side or whatever. But I do think there's something meaningful about seeing like this spaceship-looking Zeekr van driving around and being like, what is that? And it's painted light blue. And I'm like, oh, I never see that. And then you see the same thing with the Cybercab. Where that falls apart is if you cannot solve the software to the level that you can fully remove the pedals and steering wheel, which is a big problem, then you kind of still have to have it. And then like the only one of two seats in the rideshare, there's just going to be like a steering wheel in front of you. Is it going to move? Is it going to disconnect when the system is operating? Are we just going to have one person rides for a while? Like all these weird niche things that are just, they're questions that came up when they first showed us the Cybercab idea a long time ago, and they haven't really clarified any of it. I don't think that that means that it's not going to be important or it's going to fail, but I think we're a long way from them saying, okay, the car's driving, the steering wheel's gone, and you can own it, and then it could go out and make money for you. And when people own it, you have to deal with the fact that they might not clean it to the degree that Tesla expects. They might not maintain it all the way, and sensors will fail, and you're not going to have constant one-to-one remote diagnostic support for it the way you will. Like when a Waymo breaks, there is a response team that can immediately handle that. Or maybe Tesla will include that as part of the we just don't know how any of it will work.
That's even like, that feels to me like steps in the future. You know, the whole owning it yourself and being able to buy it and have your small fleet of Cybercabs where you're earning all this side income. This is something that Tesla fans are really excited about.
Well, that's the whole promise, right? Like if the point was we're going to be able to do robo-taxis with specialized, you know, company-owned hardware in specific cities in the United States, like there is no magic sauce. That's already happening. So if you want to do something better, you have to deliver on what Tesla's always promised, which is, no, we're going to make
your
autonomy so cheap,
you can
have it. Yeah. Which I think is a much, much more compelling pitch. Kyle from Out of Spec recently did a video that was good on the what he considers the golden age of personal autonomy. And he was like, eventually, these systems are going to get more regulated and like watch you more closely. But before, they weren't good enough. And right now is a great situation for personal owned autonomy, which he said is much more important than the Uber and the, you know, the Uber equivalent, the Waymo equivalent. And I found it kind of persuasive what he said, which is just when you have a Waymo, it's cool, it's safe, it doesn't have tacky air fresheners or bad music or, you know, talk on the phone while it drives to you. So in a lot of ways, it's better than an Uber driver. But fundamentally, you're getting the same product. I want to be able to go from here to there and I don't want to be responsible. I can be drunk or high or whatever, and it doesn't matter because I'm not driving. That already exists if you live in a city. So the real value unlocked is you can do this anywhere with a car that you personally own. And I think that's where Tesla wants to go.
And or this it being cheaper because, you know, if you're the network, you don't have to pay drivers, et cetera. Like,
I think
that's another big part of the long-term promise.
Right. But Uber, that's 30% cheaper, I think is an important service. I don't think it's a $1 trillion valuation in the way that your car, you can drive it or it can drive itself and fully wherever you want to go. Like, yeah, that is going to be the game changer. If they can beat everyone to the punch on that, that's a game changer. But they keep saying they're about to do it. And then, you know, we see videos like FSD V14 Lite this week running over a log that it didn't see. You know?
That was crazy.
I still see enough like holy shit behavior from Tesla FSD videos that I find it really hard to believe we're just around the corner. But again, we're closer than I ever thought we'd get. And and in the geofenced Waymo type condition, it seems like we're getting close.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think the issue is that that's never been the Tesla promise. The Tesla right. promise has always been anywhere all the time.
Right.
You own it.
You fly to New York and the car meets you there.
Right, that kind of thing. And the fact, you're right, the fact that they've been able to do a geofenced Waymo-like service is very impressive given the camera only, given the constraints they've put on themselves. I think now we see, can it scale to Waymo size and beyond? I think in terms of CyberCab, I wouldn't expect this to roll out very quickly or, you know, in super large numbers. And Tesla has even said that on a recent earnings call, Musk said that they need to accumulate driving data that is specific to the CyberCab before we can put a lot of them on the road. So, you know, it seems like this sort of early rollout is going to be, you know, a big part of it is data gathering so right. that they can tune their models or whatever to this specific vehicle, which again is another sort of like wrinkle, which is, you know, forever the promise has been we have so many cars on the road,
right.
we're training, you know, we're gathering all this training data, it's just going to be a flip of the switch. And now it's like, oh, actually, well, we have a new vehicle, so we need to, you know, tune the model specifically to that or gather the specific data, which isn't necessarily a knock on Tesla. It's just that it is very, very complicated and hard yes. to roll out autonomous vehicles. And every step of the way, you know, that becomes evident.
Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, it's not even a tech question of how successful Tesla ends up being. It's almost a political/business story of just how long can Elon Musk maintain the confidence that Tesla is the company that is going to unlock this personal autonomy tranche of money and give it to its investors. Like, that is the play. And whether they spend a bunch of money tooling up the CyberCab in the meantime or they don't, the goal is to make sure that the narrative never shifts from like Tesla is at the forefront, Tesla is the company that can solve this. And while I think I have a lot of doubts about Tesla's ability to deliver on this, the hardware that they have so far, I also will admit that they're definitely a lot closer than any other automaker that I've seen.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot more to play out, and I'm sure we'll have more hopefully next week or the week after when we have time to talk about everything we learned from this event.
Yes, stay tuned.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Let's talk about a car you can actually drive. Yeah. Hyundai is... What? Well, you will be able to, in theory.
You will. Hyundai's announcing it, but Tesla yeah. announced a CyberCab, and that doesn't mean you can drive one. We got to be skeptics.
We're splitting hairs here. Hyundai is bringing a Santa Fe EREV to the U.S. starting next year. It'll have over 600 miles of range, use about half the battery pack of a comparable EV, and be built at Hyundai's plant in Alabama. It'll also be joined by a Genesis EREV, and this is all stuff that we learned from a Hyundai Investor Day this week. We kind of already knew, or we already knew that Hyundai was exploring EREVs. We just didn't know which specific models would get it and when. Now we do. This is part of an EREV boom that is really kicking off over the next few years. It's going to include these Hyundais, plus the Scouts, the Jeep Wagoneer, Ram 1500 REV. Plus, we already learned that Kia, Hyundai's sister brand, is launching an EREV version of the Telluride, plus an EREV pickup truck by the end of this decade. It's really interesting stuff. Like, it's not every day that we get a kind of brand new, you know, to the modern era powertrain in the U.S. What do you think about the Santa Fe EREV?
Yeah, so I have a lot of thoughts, as per usual. I did this trip. It was me and Megan. It was a camping trip, so we had a bunch of stuff with us, and we were going to Zion and Bryce. I think it was around 1,200 miles round trip in the Blazer. And it was winter, so planning a winter large amount of cargo trip to, you know, camping trip to Zion and Bryce, which are very rural, very outside of, you know, not any fast charging infrastructure very close to them. It was a challenge, you know, and we had to adjust our plans to keep the EV charged. And I remember that was right when the new generation Hyundai Santa Fe had come out. The Santa Fe is bigger than the Tucson or like a RAV4. It's more in the size class of, it's like the biggest you can get before they all get three rows. So it like offers a third row, but it's Hyundai's smallest third row.
I know.
Yeah. We're splitting hairs. I just want to be clear because the distinctions between each car company's EVs have gotten smaller and smaller. But think of it as a, Chevy Blazer equivalent, a Jeep Grand Cherokee equivalent. And what I saw in Zion and Bryce was everyone was driving a rental Hyundai Santa Fe. It was like when that model had just come out, everyone was there. And then there was a lot of privately owned ones that had bumper stickers or whatever, because these are the type of vehicles that I think people do take on a lot of long distance trips. You see this segment of vehicles, like large two-row SUVs, as base family haulers in rural and exurban America that are then taken to far reaches in rural areas. And so I think it's a really good place for the EREV to land, right? Because EREVs are best in larger vehicles where the price of adding a gasoline engine plus a smaller battery can be, in theory, better than adding a giant battery and providing 400 miles of range. The problem I have with this, which is what I have with all EREVs, is so much of it rests on the idea of, well, what if we could use this to bring EV costs down? And that we have not seen any evidence of yet, because we don't know what any of the upcoming EREVs are going to cost, whether they're going to be cheaper or less cheap. There's only been one EREV sold in America so far, pure EREV with no connection, because even the Volt technically could connect its gas engine to the wheels at highway speeds. The only car sold in America that couldn't was the last gen BMW i3. And in that case, the EREV version just added the gas engine on to, I believe, the same battery or slightly smaller battery and was an extra cost option. So I would like to see some proof that this is going to be cheaper. But I think if these are going to work, and that's a big if because we haven't seen them yet, I think these segments are where it's going to work. What do you think?
I agree with that. I think it's definitely a better sell than like a small, you know, i3 hatchback. Like with this, you know, the comparison is much more clear where, if you wanted to buy a big, well, actually, there aren't really very many big SUVs like that. But if you want to buy one that's an EV, it's going to be an expensive luxury SUV with a gigantic battery and a lot of cost associated with it. I think in terms of the segment, it makes a lot of sense. And that's where pretty much all the EREV efforts are targeting is like big SUVs, big pickup trucks. I think it's going to be really fascinating to see how many people actually buy these things. Like theoretically, I think it's a really cool idea. I think the technology is really interesting and this is a good application for it. I just wonder, is it going to go the same way as the PHEV, which there have been a lot of them. They never really got a ton of traction. Like there are people who love them and are like, will live and die by their PHEV. And then, but they just like, you know, EVs outsell them by quite a bit. Yeah. It's just one of those things where it's an EREV definitely has the biggest advantage if you have a garage and a place to charge. And if you have a garage and a place to charge and are interested in a vehicle that can do 100 or 200 miles on battery, like maybe you're also the same kind of person who's pretty amenable to an electric car. It'll be really interesting to see kind of where the Venn diagram of who actually buys one versus just buying a hybrid or buying an EV, where that lands.
Yeah, it's like the PHEV thing where people want to pitch it as the best of both worlds. And there's no such thing as a solution in this world, right? There's only different compromises. And I think even the world of PHEVs and EREVs, and God, do we not need another acronym, but here we are. The distinction being that
the Stellantis is calling them REEVs. So
yeah, whatever.
There's another one for you.
The distinction between them, right, is a PHEV, the gas engine can still power the wheels and blends with the electric motor. And then an EREV, they're completely divorced. They just want, the engine is only a generator. A lot of EVs, or I should say PHEVs and extended range vehicles in China, are more like traditional PHEVs where the engine can clutch directly to the wheels at highway speeds. That's how like Honda's two-motor hybrid system works. So the benefit of that is actually just cruising along at the highway. I mean, we know this from fuel economy ratings. It's a pretty efficient place for a gasoline engine to hang out. So if you can just do that directly rather than convert that energy to electricity and then back into motion, you take it from reciprocating motion to electricity back to motion, that's inherently lossy. That's not going to be better on the highway. So once the battery's dead, you would rather be in a PHEV than an EREV. In theory, it seems like the EREVs are going to have bigger batteries than the equivalent PHEVs. But then I would also assume they would be more expensive. So if you only have a 45, 50 mile range on your PHEV versus 150 miles on your EREV, but either way, you're only turning on the gas engine every couple of months on a road trip, like, what's the advantage? PHEVs, you know, need a transmission technically, although the Toyota ones don't. They just use two motors. It's really messy and hard to communicate, which is going to be the problem. But I think for people, especially in the truck world, that want the all-electric might for towing, but then still want that longevity, I think EREVs still definitely have a benefit. But you're always going to be running into a problem of you need the battery to have enough charge to supply that peak current. So we'll see how they actually work in the real world.
Yeah, no, I think they just, I'm afraid, like, I don't know that any of these companies are necessarily targeting like huge, gigantic sales from EREVs.
Yeah.
But the way that there's just this new wave of them, it makes me afraid that it's going to be a similar thing to EVs where demand was over, you know, the car companies kind of overestimated demand. And then hit this wall of, you know, when the early adopters started sort of dropping out. I think there's a lot of the same sort of issues with EREVs. I think it's really cool, but I also think going to a dealership, that's been always one of the hurdles with EV adoption is like the dealer is maybe not super invested in educating you about this. And when you take it and you take it to this level of like an even more sort of complicated powertrain, you know, I think there's going to be these sorts of speed bumps, but fascinating stuff. Like I'm really eager to see who buys them.
Yeah. And I want to call out too that Hyundai's announcement today wasn't just about EREV stuff. The company is also like still investing heavily in EVs, which we love to see. They're expecting electrified vehicles that includes hybrids, EREVs, all of that to deliver 60% of sales mix by 2030, up from like 23% last year. And also there was an interesting thing that they were talking about, which is that they're using new in-house battery cells that double the output of previous high nickel cells with 40% faster charging. So that's what they're working on developing. And they're already using this new thermal runaway protection technology, which they just showed off on the GV90, which they explained to me. Basically, they're separating the cells by individual thermal barriers between them so that if you have an overvoltage in one, you don't get the cascading runaway effect that leads to a terrible EV fire, which is close to home for a South Korean company. There was a famous situation where a Mercedes EV caught fire in an underground garage and destroyed hundreds of cars, injured people with smoke inhalation. And so South Korea has had a big worry about EV fire safety. And so it's interesting to see Hyundai, you know, responding to that. But I think that's really important work too.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Shall we get to plus minus?
Let's do it.
The segment where we talk about who's up and who's down in the EV world this week. Yeah. Mac, why don't you go first?
Sure. So my minus, because I've been doing too many pluses recently, is Land Rover delaying the electric Defender. Now, I don't think that this is necessarily a terrible idea or that surprising. It was supposed to arrive within a couple of years. Now it's going to be pushed back past 2030. But the company has in general made a lot of sweeping pronouncements about what they're going to do with EVs, but has yet to really deliver anything on the Land Rover front. Jaguar had the I-Pace for a while, but in general, the company has been slow to get started on this. The electric Range Rover has been delayed significantly, and Jaguar's EV transition has been weird enough that they have basically a whole year where in many of its key markets, it has no products on sale. So it just stinks to see you know, sort of like the Honda News not that long ago, just a company that keeps saying they're serious about this, but then not quite getting there. The good news is the electric Range Rover is still on. We've had a prototype review of that on the site before that was rave. They loved it. And I imagine an electric Range Rover will be awesome, both on the off-road front and like the quietness and comfort side. So I still feel like they might, you know, have a shot here, but I would like to see them stop delaying and just start doing stuff.
Yeah. Speaking of something that would be great as an EREV, like if you're going to have EREV Scout and what are the like EREV Jeep, like these big bulky cars, make an EREV Defender. That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, that would be sick.
My plus is Volvo. I think it's one of those things that I want to look more in, that I've always thought about looking more into, which is like so many car companies talk about making their vehicles OTA capable, and yet we see like shockingly few really substantial OTAs get announced.
Yeah.
This week Volvo said that the EX60, EX90 and ES90 are all getting this update to their safety suite, which adds a bunch of new alerts. And what's really cool about these, I think, is that they are derived from the fleet of vehicles. So like if a Volvo somewhere else, like ahead of you on the road, senses something, it'll like tell the rest of the Volvo fleet what's going on. And so one of the ones that's coming to these cars is the ability to detect large animals, like large animal alert. So if some Volvo, like, you know, 100 yards ahead of you sees a deer coming onto the road, theoretically, you'll get an alert in your car telling you about that, which is just a cool application of this sort of technology.
Yeah. So make sure to move near other Volvos if you're worried about deer, I suppose. It's going to be much more useful in Sweden than
move
probably
to Sweden.
Many.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we've tracked all of the deer in the country thanks to this new service.
Yeah. It might also take it from other vehicles. We got to double check that. But at least in Europe, they shared this data across a bunch of different automakers, which is cool. Thanks for listening to the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs. We'll be back next Friday. Today's show was produced by Michael Perkins and brought to you by the Motorsport Network. Make sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe to the Inside EVs YouTube channel, and check out all our latest coverage on InsideEVs.com. See you next time.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.